Hi everyone, welcome to a new season of Aha with Alistair podcasts. I'm Alistair Willis, Music Director of the South Bend Symphony Orchestra. Our first Jack M. Champagne Masterworks concert of our 2024-25 season focuses on dance. Dance has been, is, and always will be part of any culture, and has produced some of the most extraordinary music the world has ever heard. As I'm sure many of you know by now, I grew up in the dance world. My mother is a freelance dance critic. Many of the world's top dancers are her friends. My sisters and I were taken frequently to the ballet when we were young. Dance and dance music is in my blood. Two of the pieces on our program are from my favorite period in musical and ballet history, the turn of the century, the early 1900s, in Paris. The hottest ticket in town back then was to Serge Diaghilev's Russian ballet, the Ballet Russe. Diaghilev's vision brought together the world's top dancers, composers, musicians, conductors, artists, in a golden era that the world hasn't seen since. These two pieces were commissioned by Diaghilev and premiered either side of World War I. In a minute, we'll get to the extraordinary, forward-looking, rhythmical, bombastic Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky from 1913. After World War I, when Diaghilev commissioned Stravinsky again, everyone was anticipating another earth-shattering composition. And as we know, Stravinsky shocked us in a different way. He looked backwards to a more Baroque and classical inspiration and composed a very tonal ballet, far more rhythmically straightforward, called Pulcinella. Now, Stravinsky's neoclassical style in Pulcinella resonated with the French composer Francis Poulenc. So, 4 years later, when Diaghilev commissioned a ballet from Poulenc, Poulenc decided to model it on Pulcinella. And we're going to open our concert with Poulenc's ballet. It premiered 100 years ago in 1924, and it's called Les Biches. Now, what I love about the title is that it's one of those words with multiple meanings. Les Biches literally means the does, as in female deer. It's also slang for a coquettish woman, and also slang for, my favorite, the house party. And in a way, the ballet encapsulates all meanings. But there's no story. The ballet depicts the random and ever-so-naughty interactions of mainly young people in a house party on a summer afternoon. Picture three men enjoying the company of 16 lovely ladies. There's also an androgynous character dressed in the style of Coco Chanel. It's set in a large white drawing room with just one piece of furniture, a huge blue couch. The music captures all of this. Poulenc's colorful orchestration contains all the ballet's characters, their playful and carefree moods. The melodies are mischievous, fun, and saucy. The forms are clear, and all the harmonic twists have French sophistication written all over them. That music's light, fun, and cheeky, and I love it. The neoclassical style is similar to Stravinsky's Pulcinella. And if you know Pulcinella, perhaps you'll hear a connection to the opening of Poulenc's fourth movement, the Andantino, as I did. Thank you. In the fifth and final movement, we revisit music from the earlier movements. It's a romping conclusion to the ballet suite. I'll never forget hearing Le Biche for the first time. I was immediately drawn to its playful and carefree, humorous and charming character, and I hope you are too. It's such a happy way to start our season. We're going to follow Le Biche with a piece that was composed almost 100 years later, as in just 2 years ago in 2022. It was commissioned by the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and we are excited to be giving the Indiana premiere. It's called Four Black American Dancers, and it's by one of the most sought-after American composers today, Carlos Simon. His piece celebrates the role of dance in Black American communities, and it fascinates me. Simon's four dancers look at African American history, dances that have originated from the social climate of slavery, Reconstruction, and Jim Crow. The music is full of jazz and gospel, which influenced Simon growing up in Atlanta. It opens with a ring shout. Simon tells us in his program notes that this is an ecstatic, transcendent religious ritual. There's so much energy and joy. Next is a waltz. As expected, it has the traditional three beats to the bar, yet to me, this is a lush, rich, harmonic dance which sounds like it's from another time and place. And indeed it is. Simon's waltz refers to the debutante balls that appeared in Black social circles during the 1930s. For these, the waltz was the dance of choice. It's followed by the shortest movement, called Tap, which refers to the tap dance. The percussion section immediately provides the tap shoe sound, and I can just see the swirling legs and feet jumping out as the rest of the orchestra joins. This movement immediately recalled my childhood when I was obsessed with tap dancing. For several years, I just couldn't get enough of Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly, Gregory Hines, Savion Glover, and other tap legends. I remember distinctly a movie called Tap, starring Gregory Hines, that I watched over and over. I remember being awed by the hit musical, Tap, when it came out in London in the 1980s. Sure, I took a few tap lessons in my teens, and I still remember a few moves. So this movement brings back a lot of great memories. The fourth and final dance then raises the roof. It's called Holy Dance. It musically describes the exuberant outward expression of worship at many black Protestant Christian churches, where joyous dancing, spontaneous shouting, and soulful singing provide their vibrant, celebratory character. This gives us an exhilarating end to our first half. Also, Simon's musical and rhythmic complexity, I think, really sets up what's coming in the second half. To me, these four black American dancers are extraordinary, important, thrilling music, and we are delighted to be giving the Indiana premiere. Our second half belongs to one piece, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Serge Diaghilev's collaboration with Stravinsky had already produced two huge successes, The Firebird and Petrushka. So why not commission a third ballet? I don't think anyone could have predicted the effect Rite of Spring was to have not only on its premiere, but in the years since. In 1913, the Rite of Spring produced one of the most famous world premieres, perhaps the most important single moment in the history of 20th century music. How I wish I could have been there to experience it. We look back now and realize how utterly original this piece was. Both the music and choreography were both equally shocking to the audience. The stacked harmonies, the huge, dense orchestral sound, the fragmented melodies, and above all, the complex rhythms, to which the dancers, of course, had to dance. It had the effect of an explosion that scattered the elements of musical language that they could never again be put together as before. At first hearing, it must have sounded like Stravinsky had sacrificed melody and harmony for rhythm. Well, what's it about? It's pictures of pagan Russia in two parts. We hear primitive rituals celebrating the advent of spring, after which a young girl is chosen as a sacrificial victim and dances herself to death. There are some other extraordinary moments as well, and one of my favorite is at the very, very beginning. At the premiere, with the orchestra in the pit, it can't have been obvious what instrument we hear at the very beginning. If you don't know the piece, can you guess? That was the haunting, soft sound of a bassoon in the high register. Now, throughout the piece, Stravinsky stacks tonality, and here's a great example. He takes two beautiful and harmless chords, E major and E flat major, but he plays them at the same time. Add a few stabbing rhythms, and the effect is far from beautiful or harmless. Thank you. What I love about this piece is the many contrasts. Take the energetic ending of the first part, which transitions at the start of the second part to otherworldly bleakness and dense music, sounding like it's from another planet. This is such amazing, unbelievable music. Well, since 1913, what was once one of the most challenging, technical, perhaps feared pieces to play and to conduct and to dance has become what we called standard repertoire. It's no less difficult, but I guess we've had 100 years to practice it. Walt Disney deemed this piece so important to include it in his Fantasia of 1940. Just think how many people have been exposed to the Rite of Spring in this way. Talk about fantastic promotion. In 2003, when Sir Simon Rattle was asked to create the Berlin Philharmonic's first education project, he got 250 students and young adults from 25 different countries who had no experience in dance to perform movement alongside the orchestra to, you've guessed it, the Rite of Spring. They made a documentary of this project called Rhythm Is It, and do check it out if you've not already done so. It's inspiring on so many levels. The impact and the energy of a live orchestra playing these rhythms is extraordinary. Leonard Bernstein said that the Rite of Spring provided, quote, endless stimulation for performers and listeners, end quote. And I agree. This piece is a big deal. The world takes note whenever it's performed and by whom. Over the years, I've studied this with many conductors and teachers, and I think I'll continue to study it for many years to come. One of the insights that silenced our class in admiration was when a teacher pointed out, at the very end, when the young girl has sacrificed herself to death, that the last chord played by the double basses consists of four notes. The notes D, E, A, D. So let's leave you with music from the sacrificial dance, the Rite of Spring's ending. Before we hear it, let me say that I can't wait to hear how our South Bend Symphony plays it on Sunday, September 15th. We look forward to seeing you there. Thank you for listening to Aha with Alistair on WVPE.org.